He says, you're gonna get on board and we're gonna go someplace and then we're gonna come back and that's all. And he said, but I want to tell you ahead of time, your brain will no longer
be the same.
You will lose it. You will, because it won't understand and it won't comprehend what's happening. So use your mind, use your feelings, come from your heart, meditate, go into a focus point, and go to your higher thoughts and feelings, you know, rather than worrying about what was going to happen. But these shutters are opening and shutting and creating all this reality you see around you. It doesn't really exist. It's all spirit. It's all energy. But we're creating it.
Do you want to give us an intro on how you and Otis Carr came together and what your background was at the time and bring us
and
up to
date? And how you worked with Jacques Cousteau, which is really
fabulous. Yeah, that's a good place to start. Okay, well, I got out of the service in 54, and when I was in the service, I was stationed on Guam, and they had the Korean outbreak, and they shipped us out in the middle of the night to Korea, and we made the Wonchon landing, and went through that situation, which was kind of unpleasant. I got wounded about four times, had frostbite and so forth. And I became very, very discouraged with the military, totally, because of everything. And I was an objector from the start on killing people, so I'd shoot in the air or whatever. They didn't care much for me. But while I was on Guam, the Marines would fight with the Army, and the Army would fight with the Navy at bars. They'd go out and have fist fights. And I preferred to go down to the beach and look around, and I finally got into skin diving, actually, with the snorkel, and found a whole new environment underwater, and I became fascinated with it. And so I kept developing that until the outbreak in Korea. When I got back to the States, I was in heavy weapons. I was in the 3rd Division, 7th Regimental Combat Team, which is nothing more than some machine guns, heavy mortars, and big artillery. And that's, even though I had put in for engineering school continuously in my time in the service, they kept putting me back in the infantry. So when I got out, I didn't have much to go on except my interest in diving. So I started a diving business, a skin diving, scuba diving business in San Francisco, and eventually graduated down to Southern California, where my family, some of my relatives and stuff, in Newport Beach and Costa Mesa, California. And I met my first wife, and we got married and had a couple of children, and I was diving on my own then. I was doing a lot of diving. I was doing abalone diving and research and development diving and recovery diving. And it was going along well, but my wife didn't like the idea that I'd be away for a couple of days on the boat and stuff, because the kids were growing up and they needed their dad and so forth. So, to make a long story short,
I went to work for the manufacturing plant at that time for U.S. divers was located in Costa Mesa or Santa Ana. And so I went to work for U.S. divers, which had developed the scuba, Jacques Cousteau's scuba gear. And they, right away, we hit it off because I am constantly a researcher and developer myself. So I went into the research and development department, and we'd take trips out to Catalina and test. My job was to test the wraparound mask at the one stage. And anyway, I got really involved with that, but we'd stay out longer and longer on research trips. And my wife was getting very insistent that I get something a little less dangerous and a little more domestic, home. So she found this ad in the paper. It said there's Advanced Kinetics is advertising. They need lab techs, laboratory technicians, and research technicians. Why don't you go check? because your interest has always been in science, and you're always off. When I get home, I'm always tearing things apart and stuff. So I went over there, and it was lunchtime, and everybody was out to lunch. I was walking down the hall, and I passed the director's office, Dr. Weinhardt, and he said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm looking for a job." And you had an ad in the paper, and he said, "Well, they're all out to lunch." And I says, "Come in, let's talk. What have you done, and where's your background?" "I don't have any credentials except bumblebees and lizards and things that I've studied, and I found out that there's quite a bit of credibility to natural law that I apply to things, and it always works." So he said, "Magnetics, you're interested?" I said, "Yeah, I've studied magnetics all my life. I love it." And coincidentally, the guy that was working on our magnetic project just left. And "Come to work tomorrow morning. You're going on the magnetic project." I said, "Fine, great." So what it was I had a bench, workbench, and there was a cathode ray tube, firing electrons, and I had an oscilloscope mounted with camera, high-speed camera, high-speed everything, and through a magnetic field, I was firing these electrons. And he said, "Take pictures of them. Your goal is to get one electron completely through the field without deflection, without it being pulled to the positive or negative." I said, "Fine, no problem. It's an easy job." So I just kept taking pictures, quite extensive and expensive every day. It was about $1,000 worth of work every day that was paid for by the taxpayers for the research. And I started questioning it. And my affiliation with nature told me that they were using force.
Brute force.
Brute force. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work with nature. It doesn't work with the laws of nature. So I said, this is never going to work. I can appreciate this guy leaving. He got fed up. And I was getting there fast. So I went home, and I'd gone to garage sales and collected, I had an audio amplifier. I had a frequency generator. I had different things at home that I tore apart of TV and got a cathode ray. I started the experiment on a small scale in my living room floor. And I set it all up and got everything the way I felt it should work. And I, instead of forcing the electrons, I pulsed them. I just gave them a pulse. And that's all I did. And they, on their own, started a circular motion.
Attracted in their own pattern and how much they wanted to at a precision.
Yeah, and
moment.
They went from negative to positive all the way through to the end of the...
Just feeding it back to the source.
And it was... I said, "My God, that was simple," because the first shot went through. And then I did many, many more, and they all went through without deflection at all. And I said, I'm happy. This is going to give me a raise, maybe. So then the next experiment, on the bench next to me, they're working on levitation.
They?
Other technicians, other engineers were
in
working.
In what department were they
working
with?
Advanced kinetics.
The laboratory was huge, and we had different workbenches, and they were all working. They were working on lasers to the moon and levitation.
So there was different
government interests, of course, involved in some of the projects as well.
The government was funding this. This is all government-funded research.
Department of the Army?
I don't know.
Just to get back to your story, though, so you had developed this pulsing,
right.
And in the next, you're saying next door?
The next bench over, they're working on levitation, and they had these just coils, iron with the copper wiring, and they had steel balls, and they would put them on top and fire it up, and it would levitate the ball for, I think, 4 to 8 minutes, and it would burn the coil out. And these, they were called igliotrons, I believe is the correct term for them. And they'd have to go to supply and get another one. They were burning up 2 or 3 or 4 of these, and they were in those days, that was the 50s, they were like $400 a copy, and they were just, "Oh, we don't care, we got plenty of them." And they were burning these things up. So The other experiment I did at home was I took a 15-inch woofer speaker that I got out of a garage sale or, a sound system somewhere, and I put it just flat on the carpet on my living room floor and attached my audio amplifier to it. And I started experimenting with like acoustical levitation, thinking, well, you know, they're using this force to push up, and they're using a lot of power. I'll try sound waves. I'll try, sympathetic vibrations or whatever. So I fooled around with different objects, and I'd have tentative results that it'd start pulsing and stuff. But then I put a ping pong ball in the center, and I kept fooling, and I think it was 28,000 cycles. I got the ping pong ball to come up.
Interesting you mentioned that, because I recall seeing a news clip back in 1989 showing the scientist discovered how to do exactly what you just described.
This was back in, the 60s or something?
The 50s.
Oh, God.
Pulsing was quite simple. And, you know, it can be done today. It can be duplicated today, I suppose. I never tried it. I didn't think to go back to it, but it was a very simple operation because you let nature do all the work, and all I did was understand what was happening. So, and the same with the ping pong ball. Once I got it to levitate, I was excited as heck, and my wife said, come to bed, so I went to bed, and the next morning when I woke up, the ping pong ball was still sitting there, just
levitating.
And this was like, I think it was 28,000 cycles.
No heat.
And sound, but sound.
It's acoustical sound. That's all it was.
Now, was it audible to the human ear as far as the sound?
No, it was above. It's just, I couldn't hear a thing.
You're talking perhaps high frequency level? Or ultra high?
Yeah, I experimented with different, down in the lower ranges, and nothing seemed to happen. It had balanced and stuff, but when I got up.
In the UHF.
Yeah. Then it happened. So I thank my wife for the pushing into that direction, because this is my field. This is what I always wanted to do, and I think we're onto something here. And I can put my two cents into the pot and help humanity do something.
Way back then, you knew all this.
Oh yeah.
But you took it to these guys, right? And how did they react?
I took it to Dr. Weinhardt himself. I took Polaroids, and I wrote up papers on it, just like I did with my at the lab. And I took it into Dr. Weinhardt, and he says, "Close the door, come in, sit down." He said, he looked it all over and stuff, and he said, "Yeah, I know it's that simple, Ralph. I know that. But this is a government-funded research facility. We count on the funds to keep us going. We're not necessarily interested right now in finding the answers. We're interested in looking for them. And we get paid handsomely for looking for the answers." And I said, "Well, here, look, this works. I mean, maybe I don't know what I'm doing, and maybe it's not right. But I thought if I turned it over to the boys here, we can come together, and this is a lot simpler than $400 a copy for igliotrons and wasting our time with the cathode, that you've got set up." And he says, "Well, I can appreciate what you've come up with, and I didn't think you'd get there this fast with this because of your interest in natural law, but I'm going to have to shred this." He had a shredder right there. "I'm going to have to shred this and tell you to go back to work on what you were doing." Well, right there, my whole world collapsed. I mean, I thought, where am I? I mean, what? I really didn't, my whole attitude, my whole demeanor towards the world changed.
Who are these people anyway? Yeah. And who are they really working for?
Right. Uh-huh. That's exactly the way I felt. So
eventually you actually left the job, right?
Yeah.
You just got...
To make a long story short, I went back, I worked another 2 weeks, and I couldn't stand it. I just, that's it, I'm done. So, but during this period, I started meeting people, just coincidentally, who were most people I talked to outside of the lab didn't want to talk science. They wanted to talk other things. So I had very limited contacts with other people that were interested in science. Except I started meeting, I met this one person that said, well, you know, what you're talking about is exactly what they're talking about in these meetings that I go to. And the name of the meetings are called Understanding. And they were developed by a person called Daniel Fry, who was in the UFO and stuff. And they want to understand more. Why don't you come to one of our meetings and talk? Well, I went to the meetings and I kind of duplicated what I just said about where I was working, you know. And they said, you know, you've got to meet somebody. You've got to meet Mr. Carr.
What year was this about?
Well, I think it was late 59 or early 60s. Mm-hmm. And they said, you guys are talking the same thing, the same exact thing. And I said, well, okay. And he said, well, coincidentally, we're in touch with, he's just had some bad luck in Norman, Oklahoma. That's where he was trying to demonstrate the crafts, some, you know, the flying discs. And they started negatively defining his work. And the newspapers got a hold of it, and they, you know, like, well, he's trying to get funds to do something that's impossible, and the science has just never heard of such a thing, and so forth. So we're going to bring him out here, and we're going to get a lab out here, and let him with his entourage, and let's go. Let's try another place, another time, and see if we can get somewhere. So they did. And I met with Carr and his entourage. He had Dennis Ripolte, Norman Colton, Wayne Aho. I don't know, there was about six of them.
He had a little consortium going on here.
And where was this base now? Where was your group based?
Okay, this was in Costa Mesa, California, where these understanding meetings were, and that's where I met Carr.
Okay.
But they found out that they were after Carr. He was having all kinds of misses. They were trying to quiet his efforts, you know. They were trying to...
When you say he was having misses, actually people were trying to kill him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were threatening, and then, you know, he'd have to be very careful where he went because he'd find people kind of, you know, very curiously observing him and, you know, things like this.
They already knew what you were up to. And they probably were following you as well as following him.
That's a good point. I didn't bring this up, and I think it's important. You've heard by now, it's all over the place, about three men in black.
Right.
Okay, I'd never heard, this was back before I'd even heard of such a thing. These three guys showed up on my door after this experiment, and after Weinhardt had destroyed these things. Honest to God, they were in black suits. And they said, we're from the DeWalt School of Electronics, and we've heard about you, and can we come in, and we want to know about your experiments and what you're doing and everything. And I was a little hesitant, but I invited them in, and I started talking, and my wife said, no, these guys they don't feel right.
Oh, yeah.
She's very intuitive.
Yeah.
And she had a bad feeling about
She them. Sure did. And I said, well, God, you can't kick them out. But they became a little more insistent on, well, give us how you wrote, how you did this, and I want the details and stuff. And they're not giving me anything back. They're just kind of taking it. She caught this, and she says, you know, I'm going to have to ask you guys to leave right now. You can come back later or whatever you want to do, but don't, you got to leave right now. And she kicked them out of the house.
Wow.
So...
Okay, so you started in Costa Mesa, and didn't you move out of there or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, the Understanding Group had a cabin of some people. There was lots of people in the Understanding Group. There was, you know, I don't know, a couple of dozen people that we'd meet. Had a cabin up at Lake Arrowhead, which is down by Riverside, but up in the mountains in California. And they said, well, we got to get Carr and you guys in a safe place. And there's a nice big cabin and room enough for everybody. go on up there, and then we'll keep working on what we're going to do. So I got up there with talking with Carr and his proteges and his people that he had with him, and man, I just lit up like a Christmas tree. I mean, I was on cloud nine because I just, man, he was answering questions that I had on things, and I was answering questions he had on things, and it was just, man.
Connected on all kinds of levels.
God, it was just the most wonderful time of my life. We were feeding the raccoons to keep our minds off. We were so anxious to get going on a project, and we got a phone call, and they said, we've got you a place. It's just down the hill from where you're at on the other side in Apple Valley or Hesperia, California, near Victorville. It's coincidentally, because all these people moved on feelings and spirit, if you will.
Oh,
and
right.
This is about the same era. I wanted to point out that George Van Tassel was having a lot of UFO meetings out at the Integratron near Joshua Tree.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned Van Tassel. I forgot. I had ordered from Europe Tesla's big book, and it did get to me. And I was going through all the patents and everything in the big book. And when this thing happened, with my wife kicking these guys out and everything, I got a little apprehensive. And I decided, I knew of Van Tassel, and I knew a little bit about his background. And I didn't, this was before I met Carr. And so I took a trip. I got in my car, and because I was going to try and meet people that
will be more receptive.
Receptive. And I took this Bible down to Giant Rock, Joshua Tree, California, and met with Van Tassel, and we had a nice talk, and I said, I was supposed to give you this. I'm out of this phase of this. I don't know where I'm going or what I'm going to do, but this is it. And I gave it to him, and I remember it was getting late that afternoon or evening, and I went out and laid on a hillside, and I looked up in the sky, and I saw hundreds, if not thousands, of whatever they were, UFOs, spaceships.
Different various
lights,
shapes.
Really?
Yeah, they're like green lights or whatever. I don't know. There were hundreds and hundreds. They were coming over, and they'd stop and come down and go up and around. Oh my God! This is really, and what I said, what is this for? And what I got was because you did what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really.
So it's like a thank you demonstration of a sort.
Right.
Wow.
And I just.
That's amazing.
I chilled all over. Like,
if you build
this is,
it, we will come.
Oh man! So. Then I got back, and then they had set up the meeting with Carr, and then we got down into the laboratory down in Hesperia in Apple Valley, and we started setting up shop. We had a little machine shop set up, and we had all kinds of stuff to do things with. But we'd had a couple of models that they brought with them that were semi-operational. So the first experiment that I saw that just knocked my socks off was we set it up on one of the workbenches and attached not electricity, but sound waves, if you will. Or maybe it was, I think that we had a, I'm not sure. Anyway, and this was a small model about 2 feet in diameter, 2 or 3 feet in diameter. And they said, well, take a look at this. So they fired it up, hardly any noise, just a hum, vibratory hum. And it was made out of aluminum. And I touched the surface of it, and it felt good, but I could feel the vibrations. And so they kept increasing the energy, and then there was this feeling that it felt really like somebody opened a door and a cool breeze was coming through. It felt really good. And at that time, I went to touch it again, and it was like Jell-O. It was getting soft. It's getting really, really soft. Like I could put my fingers through it. Better than Jell-O because it didn't stick or anything. I put my hand in and pulled it out.
Oh, my goodness.
Like that.
And what did it feel like when your hand was inside of the gelatinous material? Did you feel any...
It was the same tingling that we were all feeling in this room that, you know, we had accelerated our efforts. It's like what it was doing, we were doing.
Oh, I see. So you were sort of speeding up to kind of like in sympathy to those vibrations.
Exactly.
That resonance that you talk about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Huh? And Carr, after the experiment, the way he briefed us on things was just, we'd sit down and have a cup of coffee, you know, and just, but he'd come out with this wonderful stuff that, you know, just about the laws of nature and how they are, that is our whole essence. And if we ignore it, we're in trouble. You've got to understand these laws and how they work for anything. If you want a comfortable life, a good life, a happy life, and especially if you want to get anywhere in technology, you can't use brute force. And I had told him about advanced kinetics and everything, and he kind of laughed and he said, no. He said that he told me a lot. He'd worked with Tesla, and he'd known, you know, him for a while and worked with him. And I guess by now you already know about the story of Tesla going to J.P. Morgan. And
when he showed the wireless tower how to transmit power wirelessly, and he says it's a real good idea, but how are we going to stick a meter on it?
Yeah, exactly.
The essence of we are in control is really astounding, and he definitely sent the message.
No more, he said, if we go your way, Tesla, we'll have no more copper mills, no more lumber, these trees for telephone poles and wire. And he said, well, that's the idea. You can stick a pole in the ground 30 feet and 30 feet, and I'll show you. We can get electricity anywhere. It's all around us. We're living in it. And Morgan said, no way, Tesla. There's no money in that.
J.P. Morgan, from what I understand, was also one of the first... one of the pioneers in the military-industrial complex. He was the man. And soon afterward, he pretty much picked up the bat phone to the Washington and said, hey, we got this loose cannon on our hands, and the implications of the conversations pretty much took care of burying Tesla from thenceforth. And I guess from what I understand from reading some of the journals, they gathered up all his equipment and they shipped it off to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And then they put him up in a hotel in Waldorf Astoria and gave him government stipend, and the agents were always on the prowling everywhere, interrupting his conversations and pretty much filtering out any connection with the outside world to him.
Did Carr mention what happened to Tesla? Did he talk to you guys about that?
Tesla became discouraged because of the lack of interest in he'd take them a new idea or bring out a new idea and show them the simplicity. There's nothing to it. And they'd say, well, there's no money in it. Forget it. I mean, and everything he'd bring up,
So it was Carr's point of view that the Tesla was discouraged, but did Carr sort of relate his being hounded by, you know, the military or being, you know, shadowed
Tesla.
As being this, what happened to Carr as being the same thing that happened to Tesla.
Yeah.
In other words, did he talk about that at all, Carr, before he died?
Well, I guess, I don't know. Carr didn't talk too much about the threats or anything that Tesla had, but I was under the impression talking to Carr that there were many, many things happening that were trying to keep Tesla under wraps, trying to keep him quiet.
Uh-huh.
And Tesla had told him at one time, he says, I may never make it in this generation to get these ideas out, but this is all just free energy. Free is, you got four elements, the sun, the water, the earth, and the air. They're all free. They have been forever, and they always will be, and we're not using them. We're inventing ways to put meters on them and sell them. They even were selling air at one time, and now they're selling water. And
who would have thought?
Yeah.
So Tesla told him, all this that I'm sharing with you, and he thought Carr was brilliant. He thought that, you know, he was grasping everything that Tesla was telling him, because Carr had been into nature for years himself. He said, if I don't make it, or when I don't make it, he said, I probably won't make it, you take it and pass it on. And if you don't make it, pass it on. But this is, it's going to get worse, because they've already challenged nature. Man, way back there, had challenged nature. And what goes around comes around, natural law. It will come back on them.
Basically, Carr did exactly what Tesla asked him to do.
Yes.
He took it forward.
Yeah.
In a sense, you are taking forward what Carr...
Oh, you bet.
What Carr... I mean, you seem to be the person, you know, that's like a descendant of Carr in that line. Am I right?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean,
and it's so amazing to me that you're so unknown.
Well, there was many reasons for that.
Because we would like to actually know why you're so unknown. You know what I mean?
Okay, I will tell you. They were all hit and miss. The car was always on, and I'd stay up all night. We'd be looking at the stars and talk all night, and never need any sleep. I mean, I'd go to work the next day and just feel pumped up all the time talking to this guy. I mean, he would just, wow. And I said, don't worry, we're going to get this thing going here. And he said, well, they're closing in. They know he's in California now. And we were on some of our experiments on some of the crafts. We operated different principles, and some of them would create a corona around the outside of the. Mm-hmm. We'd operate these little.
The dielectric principles,
right.
of the ionization process.
And so, even though it was daylight sometimes, you'd see these things, and the people in the valley that was the era of flying saucers and stuff, so they'd say, oh my God, this place has got flying saucers around here and stuff. Well, that and the fact that the powers that were trying to reduce Carr's activities was following him, trying to find him. So he said, well, we're just going to have to keep working on this. Carr had made arrangements, and I went with him to meet with a representative of General Motors, a car company. And that, I think it was either Riverside or, I think it was Riverside. The guy had committed to meet with Carr, because Carr told him a few things that interested him. And so I went with him, and Rapolti was there. And I think Aho was there. And in a very precise way, Carr said, we can levitate these machines now. You know, there's no, we're get off the earth. We're killing a lot of animals. We're destroying the plant life. He says, within a year, we'll have these things going, and... We can start with the automobile. That's obsolete. We can get these things going. And then the homes, which is my interest. I've always wanted, why not? Like the Jetsons, for instance, floating homes. And then maybe cities. And then maybe, countries. Who knows the end of it? But this guy got real, real aggressive and said, you put them up there, Carr, and we'll shoot them down. That was his words. You put them up and we'll shoot them down.
Wow.
And I was flabbergasted, like, well, why? What?
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Well, you're advocating an energy field that there's no money involved. We can't,
We have no means of controlling it." It was his premise here,
right?
No doubt.
Because you're pulling energy out of the air, which is all around us, and using that to transport or teleport or whatever.
So he basically, you guys just walked out of there and said, okay, what did Carr say? Did he say, okay, I won't do it anymore? Or
no.
Did he say, what did Carr say? I'm just curious after that.
I don't remember his exact words, but it was very, very,
sort of a standoff.
It was very, very good the way he said
it. Oh, really?
Yeah, he said, he says, it's only a matter of time till it comes back and
you can't stop us. You can't stop yet.
It's here. Whether it's here today or tomorrow, it's here. It's rapidly approaching the point where it has to be, not want to be, but has to be. Hmm. And he said, "I'm sorry, you don't, see our point, because we were willing to work with you. You could fund us, and we could show you what we could do." And the guy wasn't interested, so we just left. And that was another acquaintance that I had with the system that we live in. I mean, I could never accept. We went back to Apple Valley and said, let's get the 45-foot craft going. Let's have people on board. Let's and we'll document it, and we'll have the proof, and then we'll find ways. And we had the understanding group finding ways to let people know what we were going to do. We're going to have live demonstrations eventually. Make a long story short, we went through stages, and we finally got to the big craft. There was actually two of them, but there was the one craft that we were ready to try and experiment with.
And how big was that again?
45 feet
okay.
in diameter. And we were, by that time, we didn't have any fences or anything around us, and you could see the thing from the roads and stuff, and we knew that, only a matter of time till the looky-loos started mm-hmm. getting there, but we didn't care. We knew we had to do something before, because now General Motors is going to go tell whoever what we're proposing, and it won't be long before they find out what we're doing. Well, he said, "Come on, we're going to go." He got us into the briefing room, and he told, there was three of us, and I don't remember who the other two guys were now. It wasn't Ripoli, it wasn't Colton, it wasn't Aho. But there were three of us, and he said, "What you're going to do, you're going to get on board, we're going to go downrange." We had a 65-mile range in Apple Valley, and where we eventually wound up was about 10 miles, I think, downrange. He says, "You're gonna get on board, and we're gonna go someplace, and then we're gonna come back, and that's all." And he said, "But I want to tell you ahead of time, your brain will no longer
be the same.
you will lose it. You will, because it won't understand and it won't comprehend what's happening." So use your mind, use your feelings, come from your heart, meditate, go into a focus point, and go to your higher thoughts and feelings, rather than worrying about what was going to happen. So he said, "It's going to be a strange experience for you, but it will happen, and we will document it." And so we got on board, and what it was there on board, it was just a small, like a crystal ball in the center. It wasn't actually in the center, it was off center a little bit. And it had I think it was a laser, I don't know, but there was a white light coming up from the bottom of it, shining up through it. And it just beautifully broke the color spectrum into, like, from infrared, red, 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 orange, orange, yellow, yellow, all the way around 360 degrees. And to anywhere you wanted to go, any degree you wanted to go in the color spectrum was there. And I said, "Boy, that's beautiful." And we'd been briefed on it, but I didn't, until I saw it, I didn't realize, what was going on. He said, "Okay, just relax. We're going to go to an area that symbolizes." He used to use symbols a lot. I mean, he'd say, talking is useless. You have to use higher than talking is symbols, is to reach the mind.
Thinking in pictures.
In pictures, right. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. talking is, in fact, off the subject for a minute, I used to, one of my great, when I used to read a lot, one of my great, greatest people was Khalil Gibran, and he wrote the book The Prophet, and in there he said, one of his sayings was, "Half of what I say to you is meaningless, but it's necessary so that the other half may reach you." Mm-hmm. And I thought, whoa, now I get it, that you have to come from the soul or the heart, or it it's no good. It's just going around in circles.
Or something about choosing the blue spectrum in order to, with your mind.
Aquamarine.
Aquamarine.
Aquamarine. The car, we were in touch. I don't know if we had walkie-talkie. I don't know, but I remember we were in touch. Uh-huh. And he said, okay, we're going to Aquamarine. That's over there. And hang on, boys, let's go. So we sat there, and I'm just doing this from memory, and I'm...
So you're all collectively focusing the same collective thought.
Right.
On to feed this energy in a center of a focal point, which right. was this ball.
Right. And this ball, then, started just closing down and focusing on Aquamarine. The whole thing wow. became Aquamarine. And I said, my God, this is how did he do that? You know? And he told us later that we were a part of it doing it because we were focused on it. And I said, this is great.
This biofeedback mechanism is synergistic.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we got focused on it, and then I was waiting for the thing to move now, and nothing seemed to happen. Nothing, you know. And then Carr said, okay, boys, get out of the craft. And see what's going on. Well, didn't it work or what happened? He said, come on, get out of the craft. We got out and we were downrange 10 miles where this aquamarine area was. And
within this whole process, you're talking about probably a few minutes.
Oh, yeah. You know. Yeah, I'll get to the timing in a minute on it. But so he said, all right, pick up rocks, put them in your pocket, take some grass or whatever you can find, some... tumbleweed, whatever you can find, and get acquainted with where you're at, because when you get back, you're not gonna remember any of this. I mean, that was the gist of the whole thing. So we did, and we got back on board, and then we were back, and we got out of the craft, went into debriefing, and said, well, what happened? You know, we thought, you know, it didn't work, did it? You don't think it worked? Check your pockets. And so we checked our pockets, and here's these dang rocks, and I had grass stains, I had everything, you know, I said, oh my God.
But you didn't have memory of this?
No memory.
Amazing.
No memory.
Your memory was...
Right.
No memory at all. I remembered later, being there and picking up the rocks, but then it was just like, no...
Like it was a dream or something.
Yeah, like it was a dream, exactly. Like you advance your imagination to a point, and then you'd forget about it.
Wow.
And so I thought this is the most incredible experience I've ever had. And he said, no, it's simple. Your brain is there to operate your body. You're in a vessel here. It's an illusionary vessel that people don't realize because we're creating it in microseconds. From one second to the other, these shutters are opening and shutting and creating all this reality you see around you. It doesn't really exist. It's all spirit. It's all energy. But we're creating this. And he was blowing us away, you know, and he said, but your brain has a capacity limit. It goes to a certain point of its responsibility. And... unless it's in touch with the mind, unless it consents to be in touch with the mind, which
the
is
the higher mind, really.
Well, yeah, that's the mind of all of us because we're all one.
Uh-huh.
Unless it gets in touch with that, it doesn't know what's going on.
Am I to presume that at that moment that you had that flight of that 10-mile distance, your brain was being stretched like a rubber band, but when you went back, you went back faster than the memories of the experience could come back, and your
brain could realize it.
Yeah, something like that.
I don't know, days later or months later, you could remember, like you said, picking up the rocks then.
Yeah, but I don't remember any movement whatsoever. I mean, I don't...
You don't remember the craft moving, or you don't move
your
body moving.
And the ball turned to aquamarine. And they said, get out of the craft. We got out, and there was motion there. I don't remember too much of that, but I remember it being outside. And then I guess we got back in and back to the base. But to us, it was at least 15 minutes.
Normal time,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I figured, you know, we'd be gone about 15 minutes.
So there's a time variation going on here. So.
And Carr explained it. He said, like, Well, it's simple. People don't realize that man, in a sense, created time. Time doesn't exist in essence. It does when we create it, and we have a beginning and an end to something. We call that time. But it says, in a greater reality, there is no time.
That's like the eternal now.
Yeah. And that we pegged it at 15 minutes, and just a few seconds, he says, he just went outside and back in time. I mean, it's just what you call it, what you created is what it is. And since then, I've had experiences that, you know, have told me that just don't talk about it to anybody because, most people are not interested because they're tied up with the creature comforts and so forth. And a lot of people, when I start getting close to it, they get a little fearful because they don't understand, you know, that, and they, of course, think I'm...
What happened after, I mean, you made that test flight, right?
Right.
And so you didn't make that many test flights after that, is that right? You guys got closed down somehow?
I did the one test flight, and then we did some things that were there at the plant, but we didn't go down range or anything because it was just about... Within 2 weeks after that, the FBI and whoever these other guys, CIA or whatever.
No such agency.
Weirdos. They came in to the plant. They came over with all their bells and whistles and said that, you're shutting down right now. And we asked why, and they said, well, because... of your threat to overthrow the monetary system of the United States of America. That was their ploy. That was their...
And the issues of national security and what have you.
Mm-hmm. And we're confiscating everything, and they went into the offices, and they went into the lab, and, you know, they started just confiscating everything. And then they debriefed us. And told us, in essence, you know, this is, you guys are wrong. You're attempting to overthrow the monetary system.
And this is what we're going to do to you if you don't cooperate. Sign here, here, and here.
Well, did they have you sign something?
No, I didn't. I don't remember signing anything.
And what about Carr?
Yeah, they might have had him. He got really, really. His health started going fast after that happened, and I don't know.
So I don't know, you know. So this, you were working on this night and day, pretty much at that point.
Yeah, right.
So you guys disbanded based on these people coming in.
Yeah, and they said you're no longer allowed to.
On no uncertain terms.
You know, no uncertain terms.
You will cease and desist.
We're watching you. You know.
So what did you do then? What did you do? Did you just go home and did you try to work in secret at all at that point or anything like that?
I tried to do it on my own, which I found out you can't do it. You got to have other people.
So you and Carr, did you stay in touch after that?
Well, they told us not to. So I, through understanding, I was in touch with Carr. And I said, we'll get together again. But he was really... He said, no, I don't think we're going to make it this time.